Everybody, hello, welcome. I'm Sarah McAnulty. I'm the person who runs Skype a Scientist, and today we are so lucky to be joined by is Kandrea the way we say your name?
Kandrea. It's like Andrea with a K in the front.
Okay, perfect. Okay, Kandrea, awesome. We're so lucky to have you here with us today. We're going to be talking about artificial intelligence and diversity within that space. And so some housekeeping stuff before we get into the science. This week, we're going to be hearing from a bunch of different scientists, including tomorrow, we're going to be talking about missions to the moon and Mars. On Thursday, we're going to be talking about space fireworks. So these things that happen in space where two things collide and it ends up looking to us like fireworks. And then Friday, we're going to be talking about being a science writer. So a writer who talks about all things science. Wednesday, we are participating in the shutdown academia movement where we all stop doing the things we're normally doing and talk amongst ourselves in our working group about how we can make things better for people of color, particularly Black people in STEM, because goodness gracious, we have a lot of work to do. All last week, we gave you some suggestions on things to read and things to check out. And so if you weren't with us last week, real quick, there are two books that we recommend people read if they haven't been really engaged in this stuff before. One is How to Be Anti-Racist. The other one is So You Want to Talk About Race. But we know that there's a lot of kids out there right now, and those books might be a little advanced for those folks. And so there are two young adult books that I can personally recommend. One is called The Hate You Give. And the other one is called On the Come Up. They're both by the same author, Angie Thomas. We think they're pretty darn good. And so if you want to check them out, we recommend it. Otherwise, that's all the housekeeping we have today. The other thing that we were recommending last week that we still totally recommend is checking out Black AF in STEM on Instagram and Twitter. Both run by a phenomenal group of scientists that are saying good stuff and are just wonderful, and you should check them out. And that is all the housekeeping today. Let's get into the science. So, Kandrea, would you like to just tell us who you are, what you do, and why you like it?
Absolutely. So, my name is Kandrea Wade. I am a second-year PhD student at the University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm in the Department of Information Science. My research specifically focuses on algorithmic identity and the digital surveillance of marginalized groups. And so I work a lot with communities that are in precarious situations and that need help because they don't necessarily have the same access to education or literature or people in their community that can help them to understand some of the risks and implications behind having a digital identity. And so I work to make sure that everyone, including you and I here, are treated fairly and equally inside of digital systems.
That's super awesome. So we already have questions coming in all right off the bat. So the first question is, what is AI generally used for? And what's the difference between AI and robots?
Okay, that's a great question. So AI is generally used for assistance. So humans, our brains only have so much capacity. I mean, they're amazing brains, but there's only so much that we can do. And sometimes we need systems to help us think, to do things faster or at a larger scale. So artificial intelligence is something that's built to somewhat mimic the human brain and the capabilities to maybe run calculations, to look at spreadsheets and be able to pull out certain information. And it has a bit of an ability to think for itself. Now, it's not sentient. It can't think all by itself. It's still like a toddler, very much. It needs someone to hold its hand. But artificial intelligence is used to be mainly assistive to humans, to run those programs and operations that maybe while I'm doing one job over here, I can have the AI doing something else for me over here. The difference between artificial intelligence and robots is that a robot can be something that's very, very simple. There's typically, you can put artificial intelligence into a robot, but typically a robot is going to be something that's just machinery. It's machinery that has maybe gears and turns, like little blinky boards and things like that in there and lights. But it's very simple mechanic. It's machinery based. Artificial intelligence goes a little bit deeper into that, and you start working with codes that start to, in a way, build a brain for that robot. So robots are the physical, but you can put AI into a robot. I hope that answers the question.
That makes total sense. Absolutely. And I recently, I'm in the process of reading this book called You Look Like a Thing and I Love You.
Yes.
It's so good. It's so.
Yes.
Yeah. That's all about AI. So if you're interested in that topic, that's a book that's for like people like me who don't know anything about computers and computer science and AI. So it's a good, wonderful book.
It's a great suggestion. That book was something that I taught in one of the classes that I was a teaching assistant for this past semester. So we use that for the students at CU Boulder. Excellent resource. Thanks for suggesting that.
That's awesome that it gets taught in a class. What a like good book to have to read. Like normally I think of when I'm in class, I'm digging into these like dense texts, but that
right.
book is a joy to read. That's awesome.
Yes. Ugh, yeah.
Students are so lucky. That's all right, so let's see. What Gavin would like to know, what can AI help people with? And like specifically, like what are some examples of ways that it can be used for good? And then in your line of work, like you're seeing it used maybe in ways that like we gotta be careful of, right?
Right.
So what way, like good and bad, like what's up?
Thanks for the question, Gavin. So a couple of things that can be used for, like I was mentioning before, is to help humans think or to sort out problems. And so it can run math equations. It can help us to, like I said, look at a bunch of data or information. That's a lot of what I do in my work, where we're looking at huge data sets and we're trying to find out information. So for instance, if I wanted to pull from a huge data set of everyone that goes to your school, but I wanted to find all of the ages for everyone that goes to your school, but I have your first names, your last names, your phone numbers, all this stuff. Maybe I just want to find your ages in that spreadsheet. And so I can use artificial intelligence or AI to help me run through a system to maybe just pull the ages out. There are other things that I can do to, like we were talking about robots earlier, I can make little robots that are smart enough with AI to maybe go across a table and pick up a little ball for me and bring it back to me. So those are different types of things that work in maybe physical assistance with AI. Now, where AI can be negative sometimes, especially in what we're maybe seeing in the news right now, is that AI can be used to sort people. And so you hear about things like credit scores, or you hear about zip codes, insurance rates, which are things that your parents are thinking about a lot of times. But those are things that are used, they're markers to use to maybe sort and categorize people. So a computer system doesn't know what I look like. It only knows what someone else has told it about me. So that I am female, that I am black, that I am a certain age, you know, it knows those things. And so it has to make some assumptions about who I am. Unfortunately, in those systems, the same bias that we have in the physical human world when it comes to racism is actually being put into the systems when they're being coded. And so we see things like people being sorted by systems and their zip code and not receiving the same assistance for maybe healthcare or the same insurance rates as other people. We also see when people are sorted into systems, let's say for criminality, we see that maybe there are certain races of people that come up more frequently because of bias in that AI system that's kind of been put in there by humans, whether intentionally or unintentionally. And so a lot of times, one of the main uses for it is categorization and sorting people. And we can already see in doing that how there could be some problems that lead to some people being left out or some people not being considered or some people being ignored altogether.
Right. So is there ways that you can program your AI to like account for that and like make so that we don't basically like take all of the racism that we already have and then just give it to our computers?
Yes, actually there is. It's a little harder now that we're so far into technology and it's speeding up. It's being developed at such a rapid rate. But when it comes to diversity and AI, I feel like there is a two-sided approach to increasing diversity and ensuring that all individuals are counted and represented correctly in systems. So one, we have to have diverse individuals in the room when these technologies are being created. So that comes with diversity in race, gender, nationality, all other forms of representation. And it's important that the people who create the technologies understand what the lived experiences are of the lives of the people of a diverse population. You can't just make technologies for, you know, just people who look like me or just people who look like you. They have to be representative of everyone. So that's number one. Number two, it's also important that all developers and companies and AI developing agencies do everything that they can to eradicate or manage bias in systems. And so it's vital to users of all kinds, like I said, that the biases that happen in the physical world don't end up in our digital systems. And so systems that work so much faster and more efficiently than we do, it can create, you know, some damage at catastrophic rates because it creates feedback loops where biases are grown and certain groups of people are left out or miscategorized or treated poorly. And so if you take this dual approach, I think most effectively used widely and simultaneously, I'm a full believer that this structure can start to undo some of the systemic racism that is ever present in our world right now.
Awesome. Thanks for that answer. So the next question is a little bit different. Is, are Alexa and Google Home an example of AI?
Yes. So those are fairly simple, and it's the same thing that you have on your phone. You know, you can talk to it, but what it's doing is it's mimicking what a person would do if there was a tiny little person that lived in your computer that could go run and do something for you or go look something up for you on Google and come back and tell you. That's essentially what Alexa and Google are doing for you. And so it has the ability, of course, voice recognition. That's a part of what's built into AI and certain AI technologies now. But it has the ability to basically run small tasks. Like I was saying, it's a helper, an assistant. And so, yes, that's AI technology that we should also be very aware of. And, you know, maybe those things shouldn't be listening to you at all times in your homes. You know, you want to make sure that you're safe and you're protected because we don't always know what companies are doing with the information that they're hearing from us. And we don't always know when those things are recording. So just something to be aware of. You know, not trying to scare anyone, but just make sure that, you know, you're aware of when those systems are on and when they're being assistive. They can also be assistive in ways that you weren't thinking about. So, you know, there's a good and bad to everything.
Right. Do you have any of those in your house?
I actually do not, for that exact reason.
Neither do I. Yeah. When I go to my friend's house who has one, I'm always just like, I don't know. Gives me a little bit. Like, I love technology, but I don't know. It gives me the heebie-jeebies. So Dexter, age 8, and Milo, age 9, want to know, how long do you think it'll be until artificial intelligence has emotions?
Ooh, thank you, both of you, for such a great question. So that's something that we often talk about in my field, in that it's going to be a really long time, and it may never happen. You know, a lot of people, especially in movies and sci-fi, we see all of this great information about robots and AI gaining intelligence and emotions and starting to make decisions on their own based off of those emotions. But when it comes down to it, remember that, especially right now and probably always, these systems are built on numbers and codes. So they're very quantitative. So they're very mathematical systems. They don't really understand words very well. They don't understand emotions very well. And that's why we as humans are still the qualitative regulators to a quantitative system. So we are still the word managers for number systems. They don't quite get it yet. And so I think that's an excellent question. And I think that we'll continue to see that in our movies and television and things like that. But I think we're actually a really, really long way away from AI having emotions in particular. You can tell it that if you see someone's facial recognition crying, that it comes up with the word sad, but someone, a human, had to tell it that though.
Right.
So it's not that the system had emotions on its own. It's processing what a human has already input into it.
Right. It's not feeling sad. It's putting the sad program on.
Right. It's matching the face card with the word, you know?
Right. Oh man. Wild. Still so fun to talk about in sci-fi, though. I love those kinds of movies.
I do, too.
They're fun. So the next question from Grant and Grayson is AI the same thing as consciousness, or is it different?
Wow, you guys are asking some great questions. It is different. But to be completely honest with you, that's a question that we can't necessarily answer at the moment because we haven't really figured out what consciousness is in humans or in the world, depending on, you know, what your maybe, you know, spiritual background is or what your scientific background is. I don't even think we've figured out necessarily in medical science what what consciousness really is. Right. And so it's difficult since we already can't put that in a bottle that I can't even tell you if it's in line with AI. I will say, like I said earlier, AI is still very infantile. It's like a little baby. And so it still needs a human to tell it a lot of things and give it instructions. It can't really function on its own. And so in saying that, I'd say we're still pretty far from AI being conscious.
Right. Sounds good. So what is a day-to-day, like, day in your job look like?
Okay, so I am, like I said, I am a student at CU Boulder, and as well as a researcher, and I do instruct classes as an instructional assistant. And so a typical day for me is I will go to campus, which is my job and my school, and I will go to my desk in my lab. So we have a space where I work with other people in the two labs that I'm a part of. And a lab and what I do is different from probably what you're picturing. You're picturing maybe like microscopes and test tubes and white jackets, things like that. That's a medical or like a, you know, a physical science lab. I'm working in something that's more like science in the brain. And so we all sit in a lab together, kind of like maybe an office workspace that your parents work in or something like that. And we collaborate and we share. So I go in for the first couple of hours of my day. I'll work on some maybe readings that I need to do or research that I need to do, talk with some of my peers, and then I'll typically go to classes for myself. So I have three classes that I have to take a semester. And so I'll go to class for 2 hours. I'll come back, get some lunch, maybe have a couple of meetings. We have meetings where we talk about our students' grades, like your teacher meetings. Then I also have research meetings, or I talk to people that I'm researching. So I have participants in studies that I do, and I may have to do interviews for a study, let's say. And then I maybe later in the afternoon will go teach a class. So it's definitely a balance between a lot of things going on, but most of my day is me doing research, going to class, and teaching classes.
Cool. So would you consider yourself to be like a computer scientist and a social scientist, or more one or the other?
That's really interesting. So for me, my background is very different. I actually have 15 years of entertainment experience, and my bachelor's is in technical theater. My master's from NYU is in media culture and communications. And so I have a really long history of working in entertainment with people, with, you know, whether it be from theater to film, television, doing a very different life that's based in kind of like a lot of social science, thinking about like demographic programming. And then it wasn't until I was in my master's at NYU that I started to realize that there's this computational aspect to it, this digital identity, this algorithm that I still found to be so interesting, and specifically what Netflix is doing with our user information.
Right.
And so I, you know, started taking classes in applied statistics and really trying to merge the two together for myself. And so here, what I love about the information science department is that it is a perfect, we're under actually the communications department. So it's a perfect, you know, melding of my computational wannabe sciencey brain, you know, but also my like people, society, human sociology, anthropology. So it's a great marriage of the two things that I'm most interested in. So I'd say both, honestly.
That's so awesome. Cool. That's really, really awesome. Last week we had somebody on, or two people on, who together do like how humans perceive nature. So it was like equal ecology and social science as well.
Oh, so cool.
Love that. Let's see. So like when you are kind of thinking about how well or poorly people who are working on AI are doing, are there any groups, companies that are actually doing a good job of incorporating many different identities into this like lab, basically, development team?
So that's a good question. I won't necessarily speak to anyone who's not doing well directly, but I will say that I think there are several companies that people that typically get flack, and I'll say that, you know, Google and Facebook are two of those. But I think what a lot of people also don't realize is that behind the scenes, it's not just a marketing team. It's not just people who are looking to like steal all your information and then put it back, you know, make a profit off of it. I think a lot of people don't realize that the tech companies who are at least trying to do it right and who are making efforts, there's a whole different side of the company that's research. That's almost completely unrelated to everything else that the company does. So all the marketing inside Facebook and trying to get you to, you know, buy things and ads like that, it's totally different than the whole research team that's trying to understand your emotional connections to who you're connected with in Facebook. Or, for instance, we have a team at CU that works with Facebook, with death in particular. And you know, what happens when I know that sounds intense, but like what happens when someone leaves or leaves a profile, what happens to your information? Where do those pictures go? Where does all of your information go? Where does that copy of you get stored? And so there are huge research teams that are actually trying to work against a lot of the bias that's happening. And so I think that overall, the main issue is that there is not any regulation at the moment over these types of things happening. There's not a lot of oversight. There's not a lot of government interference with what's happening. And I think that lets these companies kind of run amok sometimes and do whatever they want to. But the ones who are doing it right have taken it upon themselves to build entire research teams that are trying to figure out how to do better. And so I think that's something that's important. If you don't even have a department to try to do better, then you're not doing better.
Right. Big time. Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah, that's so interesting. Let's see. So Ashley would like to know, how strict are the regulations on AI? Can you code whatever you want, or are there some kinds of codes of ethics that we're supposed to be following?
Great question, Ashley. So the regulation on AI right now is pretty loose. There are only certain states that have regulation on what you can do, but that's more so with user data. And so that has to do with everything that the company has learned about us as people, and if they can sell, buy, trade, you know, our information with other companies or other entities. When it comes down to it, Ashley, it's really kind of the wild, wild west out there. And it's not only the companies that can be creating AI that could be helpful or hurtful, because we have the ability for anyone at home to be able to create these systems and code these systems. There's a lot of open source material out there where anyone can, you know, build something like a French fry dispenser. Someone can write a code for a French fry dispenser and post it online, and now we all have the ability to build our own AI French fry dispenser. That's scary though, because that means if there's something that's like more negative than a French fry dispenser, that means that everyone also has access to that. And so the beauty of there being all of these open resources for everyone to use is that there can also be really scary things in there that other people can get their hands on. And so it's not only hard to regulate businesses when there has been no government oversight so far, it's almost impossible to regulate the internet. You know, it's really hard to regulate the content that's happening inside of the internet that everyone has access to now.
Right. Whew. So much work to be done. Angie has a question. Is there any one thing that you're most excited about when it comes to the future of AI?
Okay. One thing that I really love as a use for AI that I wish I would have mentioned earlier is its help in being assistive with persons that have disabilities. So something that I'm really looking forward to in the future, like I know, I think Samsung has a new phone that's come out that helps the deaf and the blind. And there are certain other services that have AI technologies that are going to, as we increase, you know, our abilities, they're really going to be able to make some drastic changes in the lives of people who have, you know, previously not had access to certain things and not had access to certain technologies or not been able to do certain things in life that maybe others of us can, because they were hindered by things that now AI can do for them. And so I think that that's one of the biggest advancements that I'm really excited about in the future of AI development.
Yeah, that's awesome. Let's see. So here's a complicated question. Can you speak on the AI which flags problematic posts? I've heard that YouTube and Facebook employs people outside of the US to watch videos and flag them.
Okay, this is a content moderation question. Great question. So the first thing to know is that, yes, there are teams of people that are moderating or seeing the posts and being able to flag them, pull them, you know, warn you if it was not supposed to be, you know, in a certain realm. The first step to that happening is that there have been a defined list of rules of certain keywords or terms or activities online, let's say especially with Facebook and some other social media platforms, that a team has already told the platform, the AI, if you see this, pull it and send it to a human. So number one, understand that when this is happening, it's probably been pulled by AI that's been taught to pull it down. That will flag for it to go to the secondary process of a human. Now, when it comes to where these people are, that's a really interesting question. So some of them, depending on the company, can be overseas. They can be, you know, in different countries, depending on just, you know, the needs of that particular company. But what's interesting about content moderation is not every country and culture has the same belief systems. And so what may be offensive or, you know, not so kind in another country could be perfectly fine here, or, you know, what wouldn't be done in Germany could be done in Mexico, and like just totally different language barriers, totally different cultural barriers. And so a lot of times your content moderators, to be the most efficient, are actually located inside of your country, because they have to have a really good understanding of the language of that country and of the social dynamic and the cultural rituals and standards that are in that country. So it goes through AI, then it's checked by a human again. And, but that list of what's right and wrong is different for each country. So if there, a lot of your content moderators for like Facebook are going to be here or in that country.
Right. Cool. Sounds good. All right. So you talked about how some different groups kind of need to be more careful than others, on social media, on, just generally like navigating the world around AI. Do you have any like specific suggestions on things to be wary of, general like tips for things to do, anything like that?
Absolutely. So I think that for everyone, you know, there as the same groups that we see that are having difficulty in the world right now, we have LGBTQIA, we have our persons of color, we have Black people, a lot of people are having trouble. And those are the same people where those biases and those difficulties are reinforced in digital systems. So for these people, it's especially important. But when it comes down to it, everyone should be following basic rules of having things like maybe not having recording devices on in your house, because everything that is being, you know, everything that you're doing in a digital space or is being recorded about you in a digital space is being built and stacked. That's creating a profile of you. And that profile of you is being sold to other companies to help make decisions about if you qualify for a loan or if you, you know, what your credit score is, things like that. And so I would say, if you can reduce your digital footprint, as much as we all want to be connected online, the less accurate you can make it for a system, the harder it is for it to make assumptions about you. And so doing things like, we talk about identity obfuscation a lot, and that means hiding different pieces of your identity so a system can't figure out who you are. So for instance, some things that I do, like I said, I don't have things that record in my home. I actually turn off the permissions for my phone when I'm not using something that needs to be recorded openly. I have the location and the geo tracking turned off on my phone unless I need to use it specifically for something. I think also just your movements and behavior online. I know that we all, you know, we have usernames and we have profiles and things like that. But if you're using the same passwords and the same, even a combination of the same username for your bank account versus your Facebook versus your TikTok or something, In the back end of a system, it can track who you are. It understands that you're just trying to, you know, trip it up a little bit, but it's smarter than most humans would be. And so, you know, try to be a little more creative in your profile creation, your passwords, and your, and, you know, just of course, be really careful in your actions and your movements online. You know, the things that you say, they really do follow you for the rest of your life. And so that's especially important right now. Don't be silent about what's happening, especially in the Black Lives Matter movement, if you have things to say, but also be very careful because those things, like I said, build a profile on you that'll follow you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I definitely am on Twitter 100% of the time talking constantly. So I think Twitter has a pretty good sense of who I am, what I think. I think I'm doomed on that front. Oh, well. Here we are.
It's never too late to start now. You know, if someone's really actually concerned about that, time does keep moving forward, and you know, the files on you just keep getting longer and deeper. So it's never too late to start to try to do things, you know, and right. if you were wanting to, you know, for anyone who's concerned out there, or who's wondering like, oh, what can I do? I have all these profiles. I mean, you can start now. You can start today.
Cool. Sounds good. So Ava, age 10, and Olivia, age 8, want to know they've got two back-to-back questions. So I can repeat the second question after you first. But what okay. projects are you working on right now? And are there people actively fighting for diversity and equality in AI? And is there anything that we can do to help those efforts?
Yes. Okay. So thank you for those questions. So the first thing, the things that I'm working on right now is I'm actually working with a lab of people who are specifically looking at how to make things more diverse and ethical and equitable for all sorts of people in AI. That has to do with the people that are using AI, users, but also has to do, like what I was saying, the people who are in the room when those AI technologies are being developed. And so that's something that we're looking at developing right now. It's more of kind of like a think tank. Something else that I'm working on a project of my own is I'm developing a national survey to be able to ask people across the US what their demographic information is, you know, who are you, where do you live, what's your income, things like that. But I'm specifically looking at where they're getting their information on digital technologies from, and I'm looking at if they learn about this in school, if they learn about it like here with Skype a Scientist, if they hear about it from word of mouth, or if they just get it from the news or social media, because I'm trying to understand what areas of the country and what specific groups of people are lacking in digital literacy, so we can figure out how to bridge those gaps and fill those holes for people who are maybe don't have the same access to information on how to protect themselves like we were just talking about in a digital space. So those are some of the projects that I'm working on now. I just published a paper on facial recognition last month. If you Google my name, you can probably find that paper. That's probably for the big kids.
Yeah.
And then I'm also working on a project with just submitted a paper for looking at how qualitative researchers like myself do their research. So we study each other sometimes. And then for the second question that you had, are there people out there fighting to, you know, to make this right and to fight the systemic racism that's happening and now that's going into our digital systems? Yes. Yes, there are a lot of people. There are people like myself, Sarah so kindly named some groups at the beginning, and some organizations that are trying to work to, you know, get more diversity into the space and also find better protections for people, all people as users, but specifically people of color and those who are underrepresented or marginalized. And the things that you can do to help those groups is if you can, or if your parents can, or if you want to do a fundraiser, is to donate. But since we're all, you know, maybe we're kids here and we're trying to figure out how to do things together, I think talking about it right now is one of the best things that you can do. Take the information that, you know, I'm talking about, you hear other scientists speak about, you hear Black Lives Matter activists talk about, and talk with your friends, talk with your family. I think the word of mouth is so very important, especially at a time like this. And I think just being a person yourself that is really interested in investing in diversity and equality and getting that word out, getting that message out. I know it seems like it may not be a lot, but really starting to open these conversations is where it's important, because guess what? You talking about it may open up someone else's mind who never thought about it before.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important thing that you can do right now. But of course, a lot of these places need backing to be able to do the work that they do. So donations are great, but I think starting the conversation is something you could do today.
Great. Yeah. A lot of people just like need that invitation to talk about stuff. So yeah, I've been having a lot of those conversations with my family this week. It's been an adventure. So let's see, next question. When you make more things, like when we build more things into an AI, does it get smarter or just more complicated?
More complicated.
Sounds good.
It becomes more complicated. It is, I mean, you can see it as being smarter because it's almost like building different parts of the brain. I just had the part of the brain that could listen, then I just had the part of the brain that can see, and now I have the part of the brain that can think. And so now I have three parts of the brain that's making a bigger brain, but it's actually just making it more complicated.
Right.
So it's not necessarily smarter. It's just now it has more moving parts.
Cool. The next question is, can an artificial intelligence steal someone's identity? Can it like learn about you and then impersonate you?
No.
Grant and Grayson. No.
No. It can, it can't do it on its own. You can program a robot to mimic a person, but I would have to tell it to do that. It can't do it on its own.
Right. We're not going to end up with a Cylon situation.
No.
That's going to be like a real dated reference for everybody here. That was from a show called Battlestar Galactica, which is not
yep.
since I think 2006. But anyway, let's see. The next question is, how does AI help people think? Or does it at all?
So like I was saying earlier, AI can help people think in the fact that it is bigger, faster, and stronger than the human brain. Uh-huh. And so I think, imagine your brain times a million. So if you could do all of the math problems for all of the grades in your school all at the same time, that's what AI's ability is it's to be able to do things at a larger scale, more efficiently, more quickly than we can as humans. And so it helps us to think in being assistive in what we can already do, but faster and bigger than we can do it. I hope that helps.
Totally. Yeah. Here's a cool question. Can AI be used to help doctors do surgery or other things on a person?
Good question. So right now we have robots that do that. And like I said, robots are just mechanical that are operated by humans or programmed to do things by humans. So we have humans using robots to do that. I guess essentially AI could help in that realm, but we're already kind of seeing problems where AI is being involved in like looking at people's medical records. And AI is making assumptions about people based off of what it's learning from maybe like racial markers versus like what you've been diagnosed with. And so it's starting to make incorrect assumptions about certain people and what they're most likely to come down with or be diagnosed with right. based off of incorrect data. So that's where you kind of don't want AI to be involved in a process like medical or doctors. Right. I do still think there's a whole process called keeping the human in the loop. And that is that there should still be human oversight on any AI that we have because it can run amok. I mean, it can, it doesn't make up its own mind, but what if there's one tiny little number off in that system that can start catastrophically changing things down the road? Right. And changing all of your data, and you wouldn't know it if there wasn't a human, you know, kind of like automation in cars. There still has to be human control over the automation in a vehicle. Yes, AI can help doctors, but I don't think in the community right now that we think it's a good idea. Cool. I think you ultimately still want a human putting their hands on your body and, you know, looking at your body and your records and stuff like that. Because a computer just doesn't make that qualitative decision like we were talking about before.
Absolutely. Cool. Have you watched, this is my question. Have you watched Upload?
I'm watching it right now.
Are you really?
Yes, I am. Yeah, we're like, I think we have like 4 episodes left. It's I love Upload and The Feed. If you haven't seen The Feed, that's a good one too.
I'll check that out. Yeah, I binged it like 2 weeks ago. That's great.
It's great.
All right. So, would you consider your job difficult? It seems complicated to me.
My job can be. Go ahead. Finish your question.
I was just gonna say, like, a lot of times people, like, even people doing hard jobs see somebody else's job and think that's too hard for me. But like,
yes.
Then that person looks at your job and says, that job looks too hard for me. And so, you know, when you've been like going through it, it's not as scary, basically.
I think what's interesting about my job is that it has just so many pieces to it. You know, me teaching and doing research and taking classes myself, all of that is my job. I think my job is very fun. My job is very fun because I get to talk to people and I get to come up with, you know, new theories, ways of thinking, really helping people, like feeling like I have a real way to actually have a voice in helping people and speaking with awesome people like you all. But I think what's actually really difficult about my job outside of like numbers and coding and things like that, like that's of course, you know, always hard for some people, for me it is. But I think it's that when you're at this stage in your career, when you're a researcher like this, the whole point is that you're trying to uncover ground in a path that's never been found before.
Yeah.
And so I think the most difficult part about my job and the most exciting part about my job is that, like, the PhD level, you may go look for a book or a resource to read and there isn't one because now it's your job to write it.
Yeah.
And so it's a very intimidating thing, but a very exciting thing that sometimes when you've reached the end of a research path, you realize, like, oh, the next paper or the next book or the next textbook to be published about this is me. That's my job now. Yeah. And so that's probably the most difficult but exciting part about my job.
For sure. Yeah, being on the edge of knowledge is really exhilarating, for sure.
Yeah.
All right. So we try to keep these sessions to about 45 minutes, and we have been talking about AI for 41. So this is great. So, okay, I've got one question for you, and then two that we ask everybody the same question of.
Okay.
Are there any questions that you wish that we had asked you today that you'd like to fill us in on?
No questions that I wish you would have asked me today. I appreciate that. I do want to put it out there that, you know, I know this is a really strange time for everyone for a bunch of different reasons, and especially in a time of Black Lives Matter and seeing everything that's happening in the news. So something I wanted to offer is I'm happy to be a resource for anyone individually or even your classroom or your, you know, your family, whatever it needs, connected through, you know, Skype a scientist. If you just need some help navigating this, it's weird times. A lot of people don't know how to start the conversation, especially with a person of color. And so I, as a Black person, am happy to have open, honest, very peaceful conversations with anyone who needs a resource. So you didn't have to ask me that, but I'm happy to provide it.
That's really generous. Thank you so much. That's really
of cool. Course.
The last two questions that we ask everybody are, one, what is one thing that you wish everybody in the world knew related to your area of expertise? And the second question is, what is something that you wish everybody in the world knew about literally anything? It could be like as silly and insignificant, like Almond Joys are better than Mounds or whatever, or like big picture stuff as you'd like.
Okay. Something that I wish that everyone understood about my field and about AI is not to be afraid of it. It's okay. Not bigger than you are. And ultimately humans, just like you, still have to control it. And so don't feel helpless and powerless at the hands of AI. I really want everyone to very much understand that. Like, it's not running away from us too far. If someone like myself can get a handle on it, you can too, you know? And so that's one thing that I want everyone to understand is don't feel like we're too far gone. Don't feel like we're too deep in the hole. You very much have control. You just have to, you know, just like in Black Lives Matter, you have to voice that you have issues with something so we can make changes. So definitely something that you have power and control over. The other question, I don't want to like create a huge fight with cats are better than dogs, but I am a huge cat person.
So am I. Dogs, I love all animals across the board, but like in my house, I have two cats and I love them so much. So
same here, two cats. Something that I wish people knew. I don't know. I wish I had something better to say, but I don't know. Cat person all the way. I think I'm gonna have to stick with that one. Cats are the best.
Totally support that. That's great. Okay. That's cool. Okay, so the last thing, is there anything that you would like to plug, places that we can find you? I feel like places we can find you on social media is usually what I say, but when we just had this conversation, it seems kind of silly to say that. But yeah, where can we find you? Where can we keep talking to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So everything is going to be under my name. So if you Google me, you'll find me either at CU Boulder, or you're going to find my Instagram, or you're going to find my Twitter. Everything I've branded as my name. And so it's Kandria. It's like Andrea with a K. You can see my name right here on the screen. And then Wade, Wade. That's my last name. There's only one of me, so I'm pretty easy to find. So yeah, find me there. Talk to me on Twitter. Talk to me on Instagram. Find me. Let's start a conversation. Let's have a good time. Oh, you can also find my LinkedIn if you're ever interested in my previous career working in entertainment. You can see all the stuff I've done there. But yeah, let's start a conversation between us about science. But you know, just want to plug, you know, have those tough conversations with everyone, you know, right now. That's what's most important in the world, is have those conversations, get your voice heard.
Great. Solid advice. This was a really, really cool 45 minutes. Thank you so much for spending the time with us. This is awesome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. And Erin, thank you so much for signing for us during this time. Let's see. A reminder, tomorrow we're talking about missions to the moon at Mars, tomorrow at 1. Thursday we're talking about things in space that look like space fireworks. And then Friday we're talking about science writing. Everything's happening at 1 p.m. Wednesday we are taking the day off for introspection and action plan creation, basically. And we encourage you to do the same if you're in academia or not. Doesn't matter. Again, thank you so much for being here, and we'll see y'all tomorrow.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.